Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody out there, this is Maxwell, and you are listening to Proud to be Different on the Essence of Success Network. Today we'll be talking with my friend and sister Chabanet, talking about justice and the effects that it has on current day and politics. The call-in number for Q&A that'll be after the half point of the show will be area code 646-727-2914. Again, that's 646-727-2914. And, of course, as always, my dearest friend Nina is in the chat room right now. She'll be able to help out with any questions you've got. So if you log in, you'll be able to ask her questions, and I'll be able to see them, and I will be able to ask directly. Anyway, I want to go over a few things real quick before we jump into the program. I want to say congratulations tonight. Lance Bass from NSYNC is getting married to his boyfriend, fiance Michael Turchin, I believe his last name is pronounced. They met at a friend's birthday party about 4 or 5 years ago, and just sort of chatted and hung out and did the whole friend thing, and ended up falling in love and getting engaged. And as Lance Bass told People magazine, he wants his wedding to be a cross between something like a royal wedding and a party at the Met. So it'll be interesting to see the photos when they come out next week. The other thing that I wanted to talk about was the big news that has been going on for a while in Hollywood is basically the destruction of Sony Pictures at the hands of hackers. Initially, what happened was some hackers got a hold of information out of the Sony company computers, as it were, and put them on the internet. Now, these things were at first very simple of emails sent by the heads of the company to each other, talking trash about the celebrities and actors that worked for them, causing a lot of humiliation. Then it started getting very scary in the sense that they were posting employee social security numbers as well as home addresses and threatening to do so for family members of the employees, just the regular Joe's employees of Sony Pictures. And this all had to do with the fact that Sony Pictures was putting out the now infamous film, The Interview, that was written by Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg, and it was starring James Franco. In the movie The Interview, it's these two schmucky television producers and interviewer, and they get the chance to interview the head of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, and basically the movie is kind of a really bad buddy movie, and they make fun of the young dictator. Well, that young dictator didn't like it very much. Now, keep in mind, last year in 2013, there was a movie that had been put out called Olympus Has Fallen. Now, it's a very violent action film, and it made it look like Kim Jong-un was capable of bad things like assassinating our current president. And there was even a lot of action against women strangulation and that sort of thing. So for some reason, he seemed to accept that that was kind of an okay thing to have out there because it made him look like he was capable of things. This one, the interview, made him look kind of like an idiot. Now, here's the thing that's interesting about North Korea. It is very much a country that is led by a cult of personality, if you will. These are things, now, this is information that I found on LA Weekly's article this past week, and these are actual things that are out there in North Korea. In the country, there is this belief system that the, quote, deer leader personally trained dolphins. The local marine place has quoted as saying that he has the ability to speak with dolphins. Okay, now I do apologize for this, but supposedly he doesn't have an anus, that he has no need for it. The deer leader has designed every building in North Korea. Interesting because he's not 30 yet, but somehow has the ability to have designed an entire top part of a country. He was born in a magical cave with a unicorn, and he created the hamburger. One of the parts of the article that I thought was interesting was is that there was a writer that had been in North Korea at a bar with some people, and when the television came on to a point speaking specifically about Kim Jong-un, automatically everybody just ran to the television set in the bar and just were hypnotically watching this program. That's the kind of drawing power that has been created around this character. And the thing that's interesting is that it's very similar right now what's been going on with this reflection of the interview. It's very much like what Charlie Chaplin did with The Great Dictator in 1939, where Hitler basically referred to him as a disgusting Jew, which was interesting because Charlie wasn't a Jew, he was French. And so when the movie companies were telling Chaplin that he couldn't do his film, Franklin D. Roosevelt said, forget about them, do your film. Free speech, that's the whole point of it. And that's kind of what has happened now with the interview with Sony Pictures. They've pulled because of the fact that this organization, this Guardians of Peace named hacker company, has vowed to launch a 9/11 style attack on any movie theater that would show this film. And that's made all the movie theaters, AMC, et cetera, pull the film. They said they're not going to show it because they're too afraid of this happening. We don't know if they have the capability of doing these sort of things. The president came out yesterday along with the FBI and said that they do believe that North Korea has a hand in this and that they think that they shouldn't. Sony should not have pulled the film. They should have kept it going. So, the interesting thing that has come about as of today is that North Korea has come out and said that they did not have anything to do with this threat. They would help investigate what had happened with this organization, where this organization is coming from. And at that same point, if the U.S. government did not co-work with the North Korean government to try and investigate this, that, now this is a quote, the U.S. should bear in mind that it will face serious consequences in case it rejects our proposal for joint investigation and presses for what it called countermeasures while finding fault with North Korea, an unidentified North Korean foreign ministry spokesman said. This is off of Variety today. So to me, it kind of sounds like when I used to be a drunk, I would go to your house, to your party, and I would steal stuff from your house. Then I would come back the next day and help you look for it under the guise that I was a nice person. That's kind of what it sounds like to me, is that North Korea has come into the electronic part of our country, messed around, intimidated us, and now we're telling us, oh, well, I'm going to help you try and find out why this happened. What should we do about it is a hard question. I personally believe that the movie should have been shown, irregardless. If Sony's not going to show it in the movie theaters, they should show it on TV, because that'll be shown in homes as opposed to direct places like a movie theater. Because basically, for me, it's always going to be a free speech issue. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. We don't know yet. I'm holding my breath on any sort of communications with the good, dear leader, Kim Jong-un, and whatever the Guardians of Peace, which has got to be the stupidest name ever, decide to do with their hacking capabilities. Anyway, so jumping out of that, want to go into the show with Miss Williams Chambonnet. So I will bring her on now. Hello, kiddo. Are you there? Hey, are you on?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay.
So for everybody out there, Miss Chambonnet, I have known for quite a long time. We have started out originally working in collection agencies, which is always kind of a fun experience. And we've stayed friends ever since. And I am very grateful because she's quite an amazing young woman. And currently, at this point in time, she is working about, what, 4 blocks from my house? just down the hill, spitting distance. She works in justice. Now, the reason why I wanted to do a show with her was to be able to go over her experiences of what she has seen, because she's got a good eye of being able to look at what people go through on a daily basis, and the things that we see from one point of view with how the justice system works, and she gets to see the inside, the little footsteps, the big jumps, and how they affect us on a daily basis with our laws and with what we struggle with on dealing with a constitutional level. So from where you started at, because you basically were, from what I understand, you were doing like communication stuff there, right?
At where I'm employed now?
Yeah.
Oh no, I'm the supervisor.
Okay, so you're a supervisor, but when you started out, what level were you at? Were you just sort of on the sidelines during court cases and stuff like that, taking notes?
Oh, no. What it is is when I started in the field, I'm gonna give a little history real quick. It was with Amazon, and I started in their fraud department. And I have always loved law, justice, politics since I was a teenager.
Yeah.
And I come from a government, law enforcement, military family. So it was kind of, you know, almost like my path was made for me. And so when I got the first taste of it in Amazon working with fraud, I was on the seller department side, and we were dealing with people trying to sell fraudulent stuff, get people's money. And just had a really good understanding of that, of how deep fraud can go, even internationally, nationally. And then as I went into school and got that taste really of law, I knew I wanted to be a prosecuting attorney. So then I transferred from Amazon to, well, I went to Boeing, but then from there I started with the state in their administrative hearing department as a court clerk or clerk. And they dealt with appeals for people who were denied their DSHS or unemployment. And from there is where I started, you know, climbing to the mountain, going into management. And even at the state level, it's amazing how politics play into an effect, because the judges really were about helping people, because they know survival is why these people needed their benefits for DSHS or even employment security. But there were also times where people who had lost their jobs, from police officers to people high up in companies, felt that they deserved their unemployment because of their statute in society or their title. And at the end of the day, the judges were able to decipher that just because of who you were, you still committed a crime. And if you had committed the crime and that was the reason why you lost your job, you weren't entitled to your benefits. So that was really an eye-opening of how the judicial system worked on the state level. Then I transferred over to where I'm at now, one of the criminal courts in Seattle. And I went in as a supervisor, and I have a staff of 25, 8 courtrooms, a jail, a jury assembly. It's a lot. And that's when I really got my hands on being able to see the action of how a case, or I could say how a person is arraigned, where the judge has to find probable cause that the officers did their job, the person did commit their crime, and if they did find probable cause, then at this point the defendant is what they're called, has to they're either PR'd, which is personal recognizance, that you are telling the court you will come back for your pretrial hearing or you'll have to bail out. Then sometimes people don't get bail because it depends on the severity of the crime. Then from there, you know, they go to their pretrial hearing, you come into a courtroom, see another judge, and you either plead out or make a plead guilty or make a plea deal, and then you're on probation. So it's interesting because you see a variety from different races to different classes, educational backgrounds. It's just amazing how different types of people commit crimes and how they are dealt with. Because I will tell you this, if you got money, you got a darn good attorney, the justice system will be on your side quicker than it would be for someone who might be homeless and need a public defender. And that's sad to say, but that's reality.
Well, and that's something that we've seen publicly play out over the past couple of years, when you have these cases of people who have money and the defense, their lawyers try and use this case of affluence. They have this horrible disease of affluence where they don't have a connection with reality of how everybody else day-to-day deals with each other. They feel they're above everything, and so that somehow is an excuse for them to be speeding around at like 150 miles an hour in their car and crash into people constantly over and over again, or that they feel that they can, like the young boy that was in, and I say boy because he was under the age of 16, who raped a girl, and he basically got paroled with probably about 6 to 8 weeks of doing street work, basically cleaning up streets, for raping a girl who was younger than him because he was affluent and he was rich. So when cases like this come along, when you see stuff like this in the courtroom that you deal with, me personally, I ain't got a poker face. I would
hear you,
and I would just be like, are you out of your freaking minds? Look at this.
Oh, yeah. No,
Is there a part where you are just, you separate yourself? Because I couldn't do it. There's no way I could do it. I'd be screaming my head off.
Yeah, it is. And actually, that's probably one of the reasons that I am not practicing law yet. I mean, I will be going to school.
Yeah.
But haven't practiced it because working at this courthouse, and it's just a misdemeanor level, it's not even the felony level,
okay,
is teaching me how to, I guess you would say, thicken my skin, because
yeah,
some things do get next to me, and I can give you a couple examples. I was clerking in a court with one of the judges, and there was a defendant in there that had molested his ex-girlfriend's daughter, and, you know, she did the right thing, called the police, had him arrested, he was convicted, he was doing many years. There was also a no-contact order in effect for him not to, and a restraining order from the felony level, no contact order from the misdemeanor level on our end for him to contact the mother. He called the mother 14 times trying to talk to the little girl he had molested.
And
the prosecuting attorney in the courtroom was trying not to read the details of the police report. And as she's reading it, I'm crumbling the paper, and I didn't realize I was crumbling paper in front of me, and the judge had to immediately take a recess and pull me out of court, and he's like, are you going to be okay? I didn't realize I had did that, and I was like, well, what's wrong? And he's like, you are crumpling paper. He was like, your shoulders are going up, and I said, I apologize. I said, to hear this man to be so – he just didn't care. He was very cocky about it.
Yeah.
He was very arrogant about it, and I said, it's very hard for me to deal with, and – I said, but, you know, let's go back in there. Well, we ended up taking three recesses because I couldn't get it together. Finally, by the third time, I was like, all right, let me shut it down. And I had to separate my emotional side to do my job, because this is what I train my staff to do. They hear very disturbing stories, very disturbing. But they have to maintain that face and do their job. They are to capture that hearing and put it into the computer. And it's hard because – I also like to rotate my staff every couple of years from different courtrooms, because we have domestic violence courtrooms, mental health courtrooms, and then your general courtrooms from DUIs and stuff. And I like to rotate them, because to sit in a particular type of hearing for so long, it changes you. I don't care how much you feel you can separate yourself from a job, it changes you. And so being here is really helping me, because I have to learn how to do that. And I mean, I've seen where we have domestic violence and the victims come in and they're begging the courts to lift the, or terminate, excuse me, the restraining order or no contact order, because, you know, this person, they love the person, they take care of them financially, or they're the father of their children. And I noticed myself getting angry, not at the defendant, but at the woman, because I'm like, this is your opportunity to walk away. There's so many resources and tools out here now for women to walk away from this type of violence. But then I have to check myself as well, because it gets to a point where you are conditioned to think that you are nothing. And that's what these defendants want the victims to believe. And so they're in court, black-eyed, busted lips, stitches, begging the courts to let this person go. And the judges tell them, nope.
The interesting part on that is also in gay and lesbian community, when it comes to domestic violence, it's really not spoken of. Even today, almost like in a few weeks, we're 2015, because of the fact that we're still a minority, we're still not looked at as equal. And when it comes to how the police treat the cases and how the courts treat the cases, there still is that, what you were saying, that a lot of female victims of domestic dispute have with, or domestic violence have with male counterparts, it's that shame and not worth anything and not worth trying to get your life together. And you are trained by the accused to think this way, that you
mm-hmm.
have nothing, and that you have nothing without. And so in gay and lesbian counterparts, you have that same sort of thing, but people don't think of that.
Yes.
People don't think that one man towards another man can do this, or one woman towards another woman can do this. And I've seen it in both genders. And
mm-hmm.
it's a horrific experience. So
it is.
When you see it, I mean, have you experienced any sort of domestic violence cases like this that were gay and lesbian in your court the time that you've been there?
No, actually, it's even amazing that you brought that up, because as you're talking, I'm thinking, and to be honest, I have not seen a gay couple DV case in at my job. I have not.
Yeah.
If anything, I've seen what's more, coming about is women now are beating on their men. And I'm not justifying
mm-hmm.
that either, but I'm noticing more women are coming in now for domestic violence. And my jaw kind of dropped a couple of times, because I was like, really? I think society is so, it's the man always beating the woman, the man always beating the woman. And that's not the case. Domestic violence does not have to be between a relationship. It can also be between parents. It could be between siblings. It could be between a parent and a child. You know, DV has expanded so much more than what people realize. And again, the system is even different for that, where they'll come down hard on a man, but a woman gets a little bit more leniency. And that bothers me, because you need to get the full justice just like a man does. If you were brave enough to put your hands on someone, be brave enough to take the consequences.
Yeah. I mean, and we've all seen how rape cases and molestation cases are treated differently with gender.
Mm-hmm.
Male raping a female, whether it be of age or underage, differing much harsher than how a female raping a male, whether equal age or underage, gets treated less, because there is still that concept that the man or the boy is going to enjoy it somehow more, because we have these concepts about sexuality. And going off on a completely different tangent than I expected, but
I hear what you're saying.
It's how in our society we think that men are allowed to think about sex and sexuality, women are not. And so when it comes down judicially, wow, is that a word? when it comes down to a case where you have Mary Kay Letourneau raping a student, a male student, it got treated completely different than how if Mary Kay Letourneau had been Bob Letourneau raping a female student. Because, and even in all the chat shows and everything, they have said, because he's a boy, he probably enjoyed it. Because as guys, it's perfectly okay for us to fantasize about our female teachers. And I remember, like, she was on Oprah and all kinds of other stuff, and it was just insane. It didn't make sense.
Well, they're still like that, where a male teacher, mm-hmm. for example, can have a sexual relations with an underage student, and he's lost his job, he's going to jail for years, he's just the scum of the earth, blah, blah, blah. But a female teacher can rape a student, and she has probation or community service or just a couple of years. And it's like, are you not thinking about the victim? You know, I mean, it's sick that people even make jokes about this, like, oh, man, I wish she was around, my teacher around my age. It's not funny. You know, this is where the judicial system fails to be equal across the board. You know, a crime is a crime. If it's 5 years for rape, then that's 5 years for a male or 5 years for a female. It does not matter. It should not matter, excuse me, the gender, because the crime is still a crime.
Yeah, and we've got a note here on our I just lost the name of it. On our chat board, we've got a note here saying that female teachers up here, which I'm assuming is Canada, have gone to jail. So it's interesting how different countries look at it differently. Because I know in England, they have similar kind of ways of treating it the way that we do, which is completely misunderstood. But if you go to some place like Sweden or Denmark, they're very harsh on it just in general. No matter if it's male or female, it's all treated the same. And it's amount of time.
Well, then that was a good point that you brought that up with the other countries, because, I mean, look at India. This young lady was 12, I believe, and they finally caught the man who brutally raped this girl. You know, and bless her heart, she was strong enough to get on that stand and testify against him, and they will convict him. He is going to prison, but actually have the audacity, the rapist said, oh, well, she was 12, she liked it, she wanted it. She's 12 years old. Yeah. Are you kidding me? And it's a lot of these injustices that are happening, not just in the United States, but across the world, that women are looked at as second class, and they don't have the right to voice their opinion, not even opinion, their right to say no. You know, and that's what is just amazing to me.
I'm pulling an Oprah. I'm interrupting you. Now, when you've had your court cases, do you see a lot more cases of injustice done against children more so than adults?
Well, no, because I'm a misdemeanor level, so we don't get too many of those cases like King County would get. You know, they're the ones that gets those felony cases where they see harsher cases than we do. The only time we do see minors is if they've been drinking and driving or had some type of drug possession on them, then that's when we see them. But, I see the differences when it comes to the type of attorney you have. And not saying the judges are playing favoritism, not at all. But the private attorneys, let me put it like that. And don't get me wrong, public defenders, bless their hearts, they try their best to defend them. But people need to understand that public defenders are juggling between maybe 30 to 50 cases, and this is per week.
Yeah.
So, you know, they can only give so much of their time to their client, where a private attorney, you know, depending on the size of their law firm or even their own just personal law firm, they have the time, they have the investigators, they have the staff that can go out there and get the information that they need, bring it to court, and truly give their client the best defense that their money can buy. And it works. You know, it does, because a pet peeve of mine right now, and that even goes into the political side, is that DUIs. We have serious problems with our DUI cases, and this is public knowledge, I can discuss it, is we have a lawsuit filed against my court at this time, matter of fact, with the city of Seattle and the court that I work at, because of a drunk driver that had a DUI with us. He bailed out. We did all the conditions of release, no criminal law violations, and an IID. And what that is an ignition installment device that you have to put in your car and breathe in. And if you have any type of liquor, and I mean from liquor, beer, even cough medicine, and it registers, your car doesn't start. Now, as long as you're clean, your car will start. Now, this gentleman was supposed to have this in his car. He did not. He was drunk, went on the road, killed the grandparents who were in town visiting their son and their daughter-in-law and the child. The infant also got hit, and the mother, they were flown just many feet in the air and crashed. When the grandparents die, the son will always have issues, medical issues, because his brain was not fully developed and it was damaged, and the mother is still recovering herself. Well, because this man has had several DUIs, no one took his license, no one told him he could drive. Boom, we got a lawsuit. And he did. He was sentenced to 18 years in jail, and I still feel that's lenient. Reason being, you have taken two lives that will never come back.
Yeah.
You have damage to three other lives because even though the son wasn't there, you know, he has to take care of his wife, he has to take care of his son. This is ridiculous. Another thing where if someone's drinking and driving here in Washington State and you kill someone with your vehicle, max you get 5 years, 3 to 5 years.
Yeah.
That's it for vehicular homicide. That bothers me. Where if you go to Florida and you drink and drive and you hit someone and you kill them, automatic, the minimum is 30 years. I respect that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I respect what Florida is trying to do. Nip it in the bud. So because this case of the gentleman's name is Mark Mullen, who killed the grandparents and hurt the mother and child, was such a big story locally and nationally, Washington, of course, the Republicans, Democrats, whoever they are, rush to change the DUI laws, and yet it's still not strict enough. You know, it's so many convictions they can get before they take their license away. So many convictions where they say, well, we're going to ban you and you can't have liquor for the rest of your life. Really? Do you think that matters when we have people out here driving on suspended licenses and no insurance? You know, you got to get tough. How do we get tough? I don't know.
Yeah, and that's the thing that I've never understood is why is it each state is different? Why can't we have across the board saying – because people in Utah and Mississippi and Washington, D.C. are driving their cars under the influence by products that are sold all across the country, why aren't they treated all the same? Why do we have all these weird different laws that don't make any sense in some cases?
And that's a good question, why it's not standardized across. It's a few laws that are standardized, like murder in every state. There is no statute of limitation on that. It varies, though, from robbery, theft, rape, vehicular assault. There, I guess you want to give each state their own right to – excuse me, there's federal laws. You have your federal laws for each of these crimes, but then they send it down to the state – to fine-tune it where they feel it's acceptable for their state and why they're able to do it. Because then you even got the state level, but then you come down to the county level and to the city level. So each level of the government calls their own shots of how to deal with crimes. Why it's that way, we can look at the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. There's no real simple answer to it. Should it be standardized across the board? Yes, I agree with that. If you kill someone here, drinking and driving, and Florida gives 30 years, damn well Washington should too.
Yeah.
You know, we're not above anybody. We're not better than people. We should be across the board. So people can expect what they're going to deal with, regardless if you're in Oregon, Texas, Nevada. You know you're going to face the same sentence regardless.
Yeah. Now, I got in the board a question, statement in question. The police set up here and pull cars over to check and see if you've been drinking. So they have them all year round, but more so right now. Do you see a lot more DUIs and that sort of thing come through on certain parts of the year? Because of those checkpoints.
Oh, yeah. And we do. And that's why the cops are out here.
July and November, December are really popular.
Well, yeah. They call it, if I believe it's still the same term, it's X-52. And it's just a term that there's, or X-10, is there's extra cops out patrolling for DUIs, and now that we've legalized marijuana, they're also looking for people under the influence of marijuana driving. And the 4th of July is a heavy one. Like this year, 4th of July fell on a Friday. Well, my jail court is open that Saturday. Plenty of DUIs. Labor Day, also another strong one of DUIs the following day. Thanksgiving as well, the day after Thanksgiving. Christmas, yeah, we get a lot on Christmas, the day after Christmas, and New Year's. So it's particular holidays, also St. Patty's Day. For some reason, we get a lot of people the following day in jail.
Because there's so much drinking involved that one specifically. It's crazy.
And it does. And it's just not even an increase in DUIs. It's also an increase of domestic violence as well. So and especially around the holidays for domestic violence, because it sets in people's financials, housing, food, clothes, employment, you know, all those play into effect, which start to anger people, and people take the anger out in a violent way. So that really becomes strong around the holidays.
Okay, so Nina, who's in charge of our chat, wanted to jump on for a second, if that was okay. She wanted to talk about what the checkpoints were like up in Canada, so we can get that point in. So let me bring her on
here real quick.
Are you there, Nina?
I sure am. Hey. Good afternoon, everyone. Hi, Chabanet. Nice to talk
to
you. Okay, everyone. Up here in Canada, we have a thing called check stops. Now, the police set up barricades, and they pull over anybody driving on that particular road. Like, they'll set them up tonight all over the city. They'll probably have between 4 and 6 on the major thoroughfares in the city here in Edmonton. And I'm in Alberta, Canada, everybody. But anyways, they do this all over Canada. They pull over people. If you have been drinking, you will be charged right then and there. They have the breathalyzers in the vehicles. You'll be charged. Your vehicle will be towed, and you will be put in jail.
Hello.
So that is what they are doing up here in Canada. They've been doing it for a long time, but there is still too many people drinking and driving.
Now,
yes,
with these points, is it the same sort of system in all of Canada? Or is it just in your area?
No,
okay.
So
all of Canada, from the West Coast to the East Coast, has the rule. And I think that's very smart, because it treats it responsibly and respecting the fact that this is a real issue. A lot of people still don't deal with it. I mean, I'm sorry. It may have a thing with me being in recovery, but the simple fact of those stupid, like, hey, we're selling alcohol, let's party, drink responsibly, is so BS. I am sorry.
Oh, no, you see them.
Everybody has the right to drink. They can drink as heavy as they want, but I'm sorry. Those little sign things just get on my nerves so badly. So now with Canada, with the drinking thing there, what your guys' drinking age is shorter than ours, right? You guys are able to drink in your teens.
It all depends on the province. Here in Alberta, it's legal ages is 18. In Saskatchewan and British Columbia, it's 19. Ontario, I believe, is 19. I think the majority are sitting around 19. And if I'm not mistaken, there is maybe one holdout at 21, but I'm not too sure about that. I think the majority, it's 18 and 19, your legal age. It's not consistent across the whole country, but it's like down there, right? It all depends what state you're in.
As I understand it, in the UK, it's 18 as well, whereas here in the States, it's 21. And it's been 21 just about forever.
It's not 21 everywhere, is it?
Oh, yeah, it's 21 in the whole United States.
Yeah, all across the board. So it would be interesting to see if something that people have always talked about is changing those laws. Now, Shab, from your point of view, from what you see, do you think lowering
the
laws would damage so much more because of how our mentality is when we're teenagers? Because I know when I was 18, I was drinking up a storm. And that's why I got sober at 21.
Yeah, no, same here. I mean, we was underage drinking, thought we were badasses. No, I think it needs to stay at 21. If anything, I would even say raise it more, because each generation is different. And right now we have too many kids who are overdosing on the fake marijuana. I think it's called Silva or something like that. It's synthetic weed.
Yeah.
The kids are
yeah.
not responsible on drinking and driving. And we don't have enough programs as is for people who have drinking problems, drug problems. That's why I voted against the marijuana being legalized. I felt we need to have more programs that are available to help people with drinking or drug problems and be able to provide that as much as they need it before you legalize any type of marijuana. And it's bad enough that these kids are already drinking and driving, regardless if it's legal or not, and we already have enough adults drinking and driving. I think to lower the age would definitely put society in a more dangerous situation than we're already in. And we would definitely need more officers on the road to patrol and catch these drunk drivers out here. And yet what's amazing is that I have friends who are Italian, and in Italy, kids who are like 9, 10 years old are drinking a glass of wine because that's how
yeah.
they do it in their family, and their DUIs are not that high compared to the United States. Now, it doesn't mean they don't have alcoholism problems there or drug problems, but their mentality is they teach the kids at a young age how to drink and how to be responsible with the drinking, and
yeah.
I was blown away
that
by that. I said, I'll be darned.
And that was something I was going to ask was, do you think it would differ if we had specific classes in, say, high school, late junior high into high school, where they spoke honestly about, okay, so here's alcohol. When are you drinking? Some of you are, some of you aren't. It's not a big deal. We're going to talk to you respectively about this issue. This is pot. This is what pot is like. Because when I went to an alternative high school, they were all like, oh, yeah, we totally know you guys are doing this. Let's just be honest and say, okay, this is how it's going to affect you. If you keep doing it, meth will destroy your brain. If you keep doing pot, you're going to be a stoner, and 7-Eleven is going to be basically your diet for the rest of your life. So respectfully, do you think having courses like that in a high school level would make a difference?
You know
what
it probably
would have to deal with.
I think it could. And be realistic about it, because when I have my nieces and nephews and they range from 3 to 20, I keep it real with
mm-hmm.
these guys about drinking
yeah.
and drugs. Their parents have kept it real. They've explained to them the consequences of their actions. They've also had friends. They've lost friends to drugs or drinking, or their lives just filed out of control. So I think the more we educate the children or the
mm-hmm.
generations coming up, they'll have a better mindset or more common sense of the consequences of their actions. No one's saying when you're 21 and over that you shouldn't drink. No, enjoy yourself if you know how to do it responsibly. You know, if you don't know how to do that, then don't do it. And that's where we're lacking on kids. I mean, hell, they're even trying to talk about sex education. And, oh, parents get it. Nah, I don't want you teaching my kid that, this and that. 2 years later, your kid's pregnant. So educate these kids. If, you know, show them these pictures of drinking and driving, people hanging out the cars, the arms are missing, their head is through the windshield, or smoking drugs and trying to drive, and your car is off the bridge, and there's the body floating. I mean, if you have to use scare tactics, do it. Not to really change the subject, I like that show on A&E. I think it's Scared Straight for these little
yeah.
punks out here that think they're so bad and tough and want to be a gangbanger, and they put them in the prison with hardcore murderers and racists and robbers and all this. And, boy, they
yeah.
give it to them kids. And these kids come out, they've checked, they even do a follow-up a year later, and the kids are doing good because they saw what their future looked like if they stayed on the path that they're on. So, again, educate these kids. These kids are drinking in middle school, in elementary. If you have to start that young,
yeah.
then do it. Parents, talk to your
no,
kids
yeah,
about.
I started drinking when I was 10. And I
yeah.
tell people that, and they're like stunned at it. And I'm like, my mom had alcohol in the bottom part of the refrigerator. I had access to it because she was unconscious, sleeping for most of the 70s and 80s, and that was it. And I just kept partying until I got older.
And
people
see,
are
and
like,
that's what
you- oh. Sorry.
And that's what you need to do. Oh, no, no, no. Mm-hmm. You got to educate. I mean, and that's what a lot of, not a lot, but some of the judges at our, my job, is when they do come across, you know, defendants who have drug problems or drinking problems, they make them go to not just AA, but they make them go get alcohol and drug assessments to really, do you have a problem?
Yeah.
You know, get psychological help. Maybe you there's a reason behind why you're drinking or doing drugs. They also make them go to the victims panel where they have to face people who have lost loved ones to someone who was drinking and driving or doing drugs and driving. And these defendants come back and they said, it's the panel, the victim's panel. Or they meet the people who have been hit by a drunk driver and they're paralyzed or they're deformed or, you know, there's mental disabilities going on. They said that's what scares them. That's what shocks them back to, you know what, it's not that serious.
Yeah.
Let me put
okay,
it down
got...
or...
Sorry, I got a caller, so give me a second here. Is it okay if I go ahead and put you on mute, Nina?
Yeah, I just want to interject 1 second here. We do have a program about drinking and drugs in our schools up here.
Oh,
you know what?
Geez.
The kids are like, it's not going to happen to me. I'm tougher than that. And they bring actual vehicles in where kids have been killed.
Oh.
They bring them to the
wow.
school. And the kids, oh, yeah, they look at this. They're in junior high. They look at this. Yeah, it's not going to happen to me. But it still does. So we are educating our kids up here, but they are still drinking and driving. That's called peer pressure. And how we've got to talk to them about peer pressure. Because the kids are still doing it. So I will go back on mute. Yeah, this is a real
good point.
Thank you. That was awesome. That was a good point. I appreciate it.
Yeah, wow.
So I'll go ahead and get you there. And our caller is calling from area code 253. Who am I speaking with?
This is Linus, and I want to remain mute. I'm enjoying the show.
Oh. Okay. Sorry about that.
Hi. Yeah, I'm just listening. Go ahead. This is a very good show.
I appreciate it, dear. I'll put you back there. Hold on a second.
Okay.
So, I think the idea, because the Scared Straight program is something that came around from the 70s. There was a documentary that was made where they took a handful of kids and they took them to a prison in New York State, I think it was, and both young boys and females, and basically did what that show that you see now is, but this was the 70s, and this is a lot scarier.
Mm. Yeah,
you can
I
imagine
that.
Such a thing. And it's an amazing documentary. It is called Scared Straight. And anybody out there who sees it, I think, even as an adult, when you've gone through stuff, it's still paralyzing. And I think it's something that everybody needs to watch at least once in their life. And it's also, there was a documentary, I can't think of the name of it now, but there was a documentary made back in the 80s, late 70s, early 80s here in Seattle about the homeless youth problem. And it was also another documentary I think that everybody needs to see because nothing else has been shown that's like that. And I'm very much about education. I think we need to get more education out there. And what Nina was saying about the peer pressure thing I think is very smart because when I was a teenager – it was very much peer pressure. I started smoking because I was hanging out with friends at Apple Blossom in Wenatchee 1 year. And they're like, oh, here, try this. And we're sitting in the car driving down, doing the cruising thing down the road in downtown Wenatchee. And they're like, oh, you got to try it. You got to try it. It's really cool. You'll be awesome. And, of course, I was like, oh, yeah, sure, I'm an idiot. And I stopped smoking this past August. So it was like from 16, 17 until now, 43. So it was basically peer pressure that I got stuck on that horrible addiction. And with drinking and whatnot, that was me. That was something I just did on my own. But when I got into a social situation, it upped the ante really high. I was lucky enough that I never had any sort of going to jail or drunk driving or anything like that. I was very lucky on that. And when I see these cases, and it just breaks my heart for the most part, it just kills me, because I know that they're smarter than that, but they're just such horrible situations. I've got a note here on the board that I believe Nina has put up saying, I have contact with my grandkids if they are out drinking and whomever is driving them home has been drinking. They are to call me no matter what time it is, and I will either pick them up or get a cab for them and pay for it, which I think is awesome, because a lot of people nowadays, it seems like that there are more contacts with family members that are, or friends and family, are able to help out with kids who are in a drinking situation. Do you see that a lot more? Do you, on your own personal world, in your bubble, do you get to see that sort of thing where there's more contact with adults for the kids to be able to say, okay, if you're in a situation that you don't feel comfortable with or you need help, let me know?
Oh, yeah, in a heartbeat. We tell the kids, you know, my niece and nephews, the ones that are out here now, that are...
I never felt that from my side. I didn't see that with a lot of adults.
We ride these kids.
I don't know if it's because I grew up in a small town or if it was the 80s or what. Kind of jumping back, because we got a few minutes left, jumping back to the main course I wanted to get to. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about was this week, it's been said now that they're believing some of the people that were speaking in the Ferguson case lied under oath. Do you think, from your standpoint, from what you've seen, do you think that that's going to be making people have to reexamine the case, or do you think the case is just going to stand as is?
It would be up to the prosecutor if they wanted to, go forward again and refile it, because the grand jury didn't see the reason to press any charges. So
yeah.
If there was any perjury on any of the witnesses on the stand and they can prove that it did take place and it's beneficial for the prosecution to refile and start again and actually have some credible witnesses that saw the whole scene and could possibly get them a conviction, then, yeah, I can see them going forward. But if they are not going to get in a conviction – then, no, they won't go forward. And I truly believe the prosecution was under a lot of pressure to go forward with this case in the first place. And so much media attention was there that's why they went forward. 'Cause that's such a hot case, you know, because there are discrepancies in the judicial system when it comes to race. We've all known that. It's also there for gender. It's also there for your sexual orientation, your money, your class. We all see that, you know. I think I'm blessed because I'm already in the system and I can see it for myself it's injustices. It really is. And unfortunately, it's such a limelight right now between black and white that other people are not having their voice heard. You know, it's not that Asians are not discriminated or, you know, the gay communities are not discriminated or someone who's handicapped is not discriminated. It's just so unfortunate that society only sees black and white, that other voices are not being heard. They're not being protected. I don't see Sharpton or Jesse Jackson stepping out here for the other people who have been you know, decriminalized or they've received injustice by the judicial system. I don't see them out there marching. And another thing that pisses me off here, too, is that there's also black-on-black crime. There's white-on-white crime. There's Asian-on-Asian crime. Every freaking race crime on crime. And yet, I don't see anybody marching for those. You know, we have to stop saying, oh, it's always the white cops trying to bring down black people. That's not true. Yes, every life matters. It's not black lives matter. Every life matters. And people need to realize it's just a handful of bad cops out there. And it's unfortunate that these bad cops are overshadowing the good cops who are actually out here risking their lives every day to make sure citizens are safe. Because people need to realize these officers have families. They want to go home, too. Why shouldn't they have the right to go home and kiss their families like the rest of us do? Now, these bad cops out here, yes, they should be justified. I mean, not justified, excuse me. Well, I shouldn't say crucified either. But they should have charges brought against them, and they should be convicted. Now, the reason people are losing faith in cops, unfortunately, is because it was just back-to-back cases of cops not being indicted for their crimes. Now, the Michael Brown and the Ferguson, both sides, both families have lost. This is a cop that took a life. He has to live with that for the rest of his life. The Browns family have lost a son, and they have to deal with that for the rest of their lives. But people have to look at the facts. And I'll wrap this up real quick. The young man robbed a store. The young man was walking in the middle of the street. The officer told him to move. For some reason, the young man got big and bad, went after the cop. You know, of course, there's some discrepancies in that story. But it could have been avoided if the young man hadn't robbed, if the young man wasn't walking in the street. Maybe this cop was too trigger happy. Maybe he should have been in a different unit, a different department. Who knows? But at the same time, instead of just jumping on black and white, why don't these communities get together and start talking? Come together as a people and start talking. Retrain these cops as well, because you got trigger happy cops out there too. Just the prime example, the gentleman, Eric Gardner, he was selling cigarettes on the streets in New York. Now, other officers have called in and actually defended Mr. Eric Gardner and said, why didn't the cop just give him a citation? Why did he have to make such a big deal about it? And come to find out, this officer had 4 lawsuits filed against him, and 3 of them the city of New York had to pay, and they're getting ready to pay the 4th one. Why is this cop still on the force?
Yeah.
How did the grand jury not see this officer not guilty? You know, but of course they didn't know about those other cases because it had nothing to do with Eric Gardner. You know, it's just certain things that people have to pay attention to. When all that stuff was going down with Michael Brown, do you know no one paid attention of this white woman, who actually was a good white woman, if you want to say it that way, freaking lived in Las Vegas. This woman worked at the bank. She was married. She had children. The bank got robbed. The robbers took this woman for hostage, speed chase, threw her up against the window. And so when the cops were firing into the car, they were killing her. Now, no one wanted to uproar about this and this poor woman and her family and what the hell were the cops doing? Oh, no, 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 because we all had to talk about the bad cop that took out another life. We have to pick and choose. If you're going to sit here and come down on these cops about race, then you need to come down on cops that are trigger happy. You need to come down on cops who are doing excessive forces. And as a society, stop doing crimes. I mean, granted, thank you. You keep me employed with your crimes. But at the same time, check yourself, too. If I'm going across the street jaywalking and an officer asks me for my ID and I'm like, well, why are you asking for my ID? I'm not going to give you my ID. I have just created a hostile situation. You see what I'm saying? For what? And then if I get arrested.
So I gotta interrupt you for a second because I just got to say, because what you said hit me funny. So if I get held up by anybody, I'm going to say, I ain't got no money that you can steal, but thank you for holding me up because you're keeping my French Chaminade in business.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, you know, I prefer folks don't do crimes, but you do keep me employed.
The thing that – with all of these cases that have come out, even as far back as what's his name in Los Angeles, the thing that has always hit me.
Oh, Rodney King.
Rodney King, thank you. The thing that has always hit me as odd is the people who have complained about the looting and the angry black man and that sort of thing are white people. The white people, the rich white pundits who are affluent or who are, I like to refer to them as ditto heads, because they say the same thing over and over again, and they don't think for themselves. They just reverberate the same statements. And it's sad to me because they're putting out these concepts of the white people are saying that the black people are stupid and that they're ignorant, and they're dragging their knuckles behind themselves as they walk down the street. And it's basically going back to the blackface and the sitting on the steps of the house, eating the watermelon and the Kentucky Fried Chicken. And it just kills me. It throws me for such a loop when I see stuff like that. And I just like want to throw my computer across the room. But it's there. Do you see that as a part of what you have to deal with, of people saying, oh, well, as a white person, I'm making judgment on how black people always act. They always act this way.
I wouldn't say all white people are like that, no, because I have a variety of friends that, you know, we stand up for each other. Regardless of the type of injustice, if injustice is there, we stand up. I think people also have a bias of the way they see certain people. They also are ignorant, and some people don't even take the opportunity to communicate. Because even with me, I have my own bias. I took a class on discrimination and prejudices, and I couldn't believe that I had my own. I was just like, oh, no. No, my mom raised me to love everybody and see everybody equally. And when I took the test, and I was like, oh, my God, I might be a slight racist. I was honestly just shocked. I really was. I was honestly shocked because I try my best to treat people fair because I already have two knocks against me. One, I'm a woman, and two, I'm a black woman. So there's already knocks against me, so I don't want to do that to the next human being. And yet, I have. I can honestly admit that I have, and it could be from my own conditional thinking, from society. I don't know, but I know I'm damn well going to correct that. And people just have to learn to communicate. I don't know what happened to us talking to one another and actually getting to know.
That's for me the biggest thing is communication. Goes on the education, goes on the communication. If we don't talk to each other, if we build up these walls between each other and say, this is how life is, and I'm only going to believe this, then that's all you're going to see. If you break that wall down and you walk in the footsteps of another person, you can understand what their life is like. Like I always tell people, okay, if you want to make a judgment call on what it must be like to be a gay man, walk in my shoes for a while. I'm not a normal gay man. I don't go to bars. I don't use drugs. I don't drink. I don't do things that people assume gay men do. I don't date avidly. So if you're going to make a judgment call about me as a person, walk in my shoes for a while. Deal with the fact that I have disabilities and that I don't drink and that I am artistic. And I mean, walk in my shoes for a while and see what it's like. That's all.
Oh, yeah. And I totally agree. And that's what we need to do.
One more thing. You've got one more disability against you, besides being a woman, besides being African-American, nappy hair. I've seen it, and I know it's there.
That's why we rock our afros with the picks and keep it pushing with the black fist in the air.
Mm-hmm. That's why I always come back to the same thing. I tell people, if you're going to make a judgment call against African-American folk because they've got weird hair, Chris Rock, good hair. Watch that movie.
Excellent.
It'll change your life.
It really did. And it was really good. But, you know, that's another thing, too, is have pride in yourself. Want more.
Yeah.
You know, don't think just because society sees you a certain way, that's the way you have to be. Because, see, media plays an effect as well. And so do we, my own people. I mean, we're sitting here always, oh, the man is bringing us down and this and that. Well, no, because it's not 1964. You know, it's 2014.
Yeah.
There is many doors open for African-Americans, regardless if you're male or female, because a lot of people have died to sacrifice. So we have these opportunities to better ourselves. So take advantage of it. If you're out here robbing a store and then you get caught, well, that's not the man's fault. That's your fault. You know, yeah. You have to take accountability for your own actions and want more out of life. I understand quick money, fast money, drug dealing, hitting the clubs, humping all these people. Yeah, that might look cool, but it comes back on you. Because when you're 15, 60 years old and you're looking back and you have nothing to stand on, or you're in prison because of your actions, who do you have to blame? That's
yeah.
you.
And living,
you know, so we have to take accountability.
Oh, exactly. Living in low-income housing, I see people that live here that are 50 years old, that are 60 years old, that are still walking like they're 18, 19, 20 years old, trying to do a trick, trying to move a move.
Mm-hmm.
And they got arthritis. And it's just, I'm just looking at it and I'm just like, man, that's just sad.
Well, it really is.
We're going long, just to let you know. I'm so glad everybody out there has been entertained by all this. It's been awesome. So I just want to hit one last question before I hit
sure.
the song. And sorry to anybody out there that we didn't have our halftime show, but, you know, it happens. do you think that with the changes that we've had, and this is kind of from my direction, the changes that we've had in gay marriage, do you think that these laws that are coming about and also making it a safer environment for, say, transgender folk in jobs so they don't get fired, do you think that this is going to make a difference in how people look at each other, or do you think that there's still going to be the bias there?
My hope is that people will learn to accept that you have the right to love anybody you want to.
Yeah.
You're not God. Don't judge people. You will still have ignorant people. That's just life. You know, it's unfortunate that you will have bigots, racists, homophobic. You will have that. That's just life. And this is why I try to tell people, racism doesn't end. Discrimination doesn't end. Prejudice doesn't end. It just changes with time. But you hope as we talk more, we communicate more, we educate the generations coming behind us, that maybe the next 10 years or 20 years, people are accepted for who they are. Hell, well, no, I'm not going to say if you want to marry a dog, that's going too far. But if you want to marry, you know, your partner, if it's the same sex, if you want to marry someone that's outside your race, it doesn't matter. You want to marry someone who's in a wheelchair. Who cares? You know, just let people be who they are and stop discriminating. And you have the right to your own feelings, your own beliefs, your own opinions. You truly do. Just don't force it upon other people. And don't become violent because of those beliefs or opinions or feelings.
Yeah.
You know, that's my hope, is that we will get to a point where we just accept one another, because you're always going to see color. I don't like when people say, oh, I don't see color. I just see a human being. If that was true, your ass is blind and we're all the same color. That doesn't happen. You will always see color because we're all different, you know. But once you get past that color and actually see that human being, we'll be all right.
Yeah. Okay,
well,
so I got a request for Miss Nina to be able to come back online. So one second here. Hey,
Thank you.
There?
I sure am. Thank you very much, Shabani. Thank you. It was a very enjoyable show. I learned a lot. It was, you're always such a great speaker, Max. Wonderful show. I would just like
Thank
to you. Say on behalf of the Essence of Success Radio Network, Lennis, our boss, wishing everybody a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Love each other. And please, don't drink and drive.
Amen.
That's the underlying theme of the episode, folks.
Heck
it's the last show of the year. I'm going to take next week off because my health has been kind of I fractured a rib in my own home by myself. How talented is that? So, but I'm dealing well. I'm halfway through my healing point, and it's getting a lot better, and I've been heinously sick, but I'm okay, and I'm going to get medication tomorrow. Yay! So with that, I want to thank my lovely cohorts, Nina on the chat room, the wonderful Lennis, who is the goddess who runs the whole show. I adore you and worship your shoes. And Shabani for being a wonderful guest today. I appreciate it, and this is my longest show I've ever done. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and close up shop. I'm going to run out the song tonight. The number one artist this year, 2014, whose album was number one in both the UK and the US together, no other artist hit it this year except for Mr. Sam Smith. Our boy,
woo!
We love him. Ooh, girl. And so I'm going to do a mix of his song, Stay With Me, his big single. It's the Rainier and Grimm mix. So if everybody wants to listen to it, it'll be there. And then you can download the show later on, probably about 15, 20 minutes. And then that'll go into an MP3. Or you can just listen, hang out and listen to the show again later on. I appreciate it, and I've loved the experience, and I can't wait to hit up next month. We've got an interview with my friend Josh. His book is going to be coming out mid-part of January. I've been reading it, and it's fantastic. And so I'll be interviewing him. As far as I know, I'll be the first person to interview him on his promotional tour. So we'll be doing that, as well as music-themed shows. That'll be my first one for the first weekend of January. And, again, love to Miss Lennis, to Miss Nina, to Miss Chaminet, and this has been the Essence of Success Network. Thanks a lot. Have a happy holidays, you guys.
Oh, won't you?